Welcome to New Books in World Affairs, and this is your host, Christian Peterson. And today I have the good fortune of speaking with Neil Kent about his new book, Crimea, A History, which is put out in the UK by Hearst and in the United States by Oxford University Press. Neil, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for asking me.
Before we get going, I was wondering if you could tell the listeners a little bit more about your background.
Yes, I began life academically, having studied at the College of William and Mary in the United States, in Virginia, and also then at the University of Cambridge, where I did a combination of the two of history and history of art. And then I became attached to the Scott Polar Research Institute because I took a very keen interest in history, culture, society, and art in the Nordic countries, and then more widely in the Arctic. And therefore, my initial academic focus was Scandinavia, and I learned all the various languages. And secondly, Russia. And I traveled extensively throughout Europe, throughout Russia and Ukraine, Crimea, and I'm fascinated by these areas, also by their languages and the mythology that links to languages. I can't profess to speak them all. I suppose I can lecture fluently in about 11, but I can get by to some degree in another 20-odd. And I have to say, unfortunately, languages to me have become a bit of a drug. I really can't stop learning them. My most recent languages that I'm focusing on intensively are Turkish, also Ottoman Turkish, and Hungarian.
That's interesting. But anyways, what we're here to do today is talk about your new book, Crimea. And I was wondering if you could give us a little bit more a background on why you wrote the book and what you're attempting to do in the book.
Well, I was a professor of history in St. Petersburg, off and on for 10 years, still based in Cambridge, but nonetheless active in as a professor full-time in St. Petersburg. And one spring in 2006, I decided to, with a friend, to travel south and travel all around Ukraine and all around Crimea. Now, when I went there in 2006, I adored both Crimea and Ukraine and loved traveling there. But it struck me that there were great problems in Crimea in 2006. And so when I returned home to London, I then contacted one of my publishers in the hopes that I might write a history of Crimea, because I saw there wasn't a book out available, not only in English on Crimea, but in Russian or Ukrainian either. And so I went around to them, and also I said at the time in my book proposal that I thought around 2014, there would probably be a lot of military action in the area. Wow. Now, you might say, why did I think that? Well, the reasons why I thought that were, first of all, general discontent in Crimea with belonging to Ukraine. People who I encountered gave the impression that they felt they were a Cinderella within Ukraine, as it, you know, and that Ukraine didn't look at Crimea as really an integral part, but slightly more as a stepchild. Then also bearing in mind that Russia's most important naval base was obviously and still is at Sevastopol, I then was of the opinion that things would turn pear-shaped. At the time, though, none of the publishers were interested. They said this might happen, but it was too peripheral. And in fact, I was given a contract on two other books. One was a book on the Sami peoples, which I then published. It's now out, and I'm very happy to say won some academic awards. And the other, which I'm now working again on, is a history of Denmark, and also a book which I'm just beginning on a history of the Russian Orthodox Church, which I find a fascinating subject. But to return to the subject of Crimea, nobody was interested. Well, when all these problems started erupting in Maidan, in Kiev, a few years ago, I took the occasion of walking by one of the publishers to go in and say, "I told you so." On that occasion, they wouldn't let me leave until I'd signed a contract to write a book.
Wow. Yeah, that's an interesting story. I've had not similar situations, but publishers, if they think, you know, it's the bottom line, but they think the public is interested and can sell right away. But it sounds like you were way ahead of the curve on the Crimea. And as far as for our listeners, I was wondering if you could say a bit more about the Crimean geography. I mean, I think a good place to start, and you start with the book, is about how geography plays a role in how the Crimea becomes an important part of history. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about that.
Yes, well, Crimea is fascinating because when you go to the northern parts of Crimea and then above, you have what seem like endless steppes, open lands which historically were full of nomadic peoples. But Crimea itself, despite being relatively small as a peninsula, has an immense range of geography. So you have semi-tropical southern coastline, rather high mountains above, and then a steppe hinterland. Now, the mountains historically served as a place of refuge for peoples. So you had all manner of ethnic groups through the centuries. More recently, perhaps some of the most far-flung are Koreans. But historically, you had various groups of Jews, Greeks, Armenians, all of whom went back, you know, 1,000, 1,500 years and more. And of course, too, for Crimea, you have, through its geography, a great mythology. Everybody from Tartars to Greeks to Nazi Germans based some form of mythology on the peninsula to justify what they were doing and the vision they had for the future. And a lot of that, those ethnic groups, were settled there in some way linked to the geography, whether it was mountainous, where they could seek refuge, or the coasts where they could do trading.
So yeah, one of the things that struck me too was the diversity of the peninsula, and from the Goths to very. I wonder if you could tell the listeners a little bit more about, and I hope I'm pronouncing it right, the Karaite Jews. Is that how you pronounce them?
Yes, they're not. I mean, this is a good question. Are the they're actually a Tatar people? Now, to what degree they're Jewish is a rather controversial subject. Hitler himself said they were Aryans, not Jews. On the other hand, in the post-war Second World War era, they have sought to be considered Jews for the purpose of immigration to Israel. They use a Tatar language, which is very closely related to Turkish, but in their liturgical beliefs, they use Hebrew.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't know much about them, yeah. But
it's... So it's, I don't know whether I would say they tend to be highly Old Testament based, but to, again, to what degree in terms of DNA or ethnicity, genetically, they are related to Jews, it's difficult to say. You have to remember, too, that in the Middle Ages in Russia, when there were virtually no Jews, there was a Judaizing tradition which went back to, the 12th, 1300s, when people wanted to refocus on certain Old Testament traditions and the traditions of the Mosaic Law, and that created great ructions in Orthodoxy, that is Christian Orthodoxy, in Rus, and then later in early modern Russia and beyond. Some of these Karaites also were invited in the Middle Ages to live in Lithuania, where they were elevated to the nobility and are still to be found to this day, very far out of the capital there, in Traktir.
Wow. I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yes, very interesting people who, as I say, use a Tatar language as their everyday language.
Yes, and there's all sorts of snippets like this in the book about the diversity of the Crimean Peninsula, from Gothic settlements to Armenians to this long history with the Genoese using it as a trading post. It's a very fascinating history that we can't do justice to in a short interview like this. But I was wondering if you could tell us about how the Crimean Peninsula was influenced and shaped by the Mongol invasions.
Well, the Crimean Peninsula was basically inhabited by Genoese. There were Armenians. There were descendants of ancient Greeks, a whole range of peoples. Initially, when it came, it was devastating. And the original Mongol invasion pulled back. But eventually, during the course of the middle of the 15th century, the Tatars, as they had by then come to be known, these various nomadic people speaking a Turkic, various Turkic languages, there were also the Nogai Tatars who lived to the north on the steppes, and gradually they assumed hegemony over Crimea. And the Armenians and all these various other peoples tended to consolidate themselves in various places. Armenians tended to be in Feodosia. And of course, there was Sudak, the Genoese fortress. But hegemony was established in the fullest of time, Bakhchisarai, which was the center of the Tatar Khanate. Now, the interesting thing about the Tatars were the Khans of Crimea always came from one city of Girai. And I have to say, when my book launch took place, I was very privileged to have the heir to the Tatar throne, another member of the Girai family, at the book launch with other Tatars.
Wow. They trace it all the way up till now.
Oh, yes, they remain. Well, you see, what happened was in 1783, the then Carter Tan invited Catherine the Great and Russia to assume sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the reasons they did that was there were that particular Khan had competitors in his own family for the throne. And also the Ottomans were strengthening themselves vis-a-vis Crimea. Now, historically, in the Muslim world, the only two equal powers in terms of status were the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire and the Khan of Crimea. Now, the Sultan obviously was Caliph, whereas the Tatar Khan was directly descended from Genghis Khan. So it meant that they both had to be prayed for, in a certain sense, equally. Now, sometimes the Sultan's name came first in prayers, certainly in Constantinople. and sometimes in Crimea, it was the Khan. But anyway, in 1783, Catherine the Great was invited to assume sovereignty. The Khan had already known her and had visited her in St. Petersburg as her guest. Previously, he was a young man. And thereafter, the Tatars' nobility were confirmed in their noble status within the Russian Empire and went on to marry into the highest reaches of the Russian nobility.
Wow.
Now, in the second half of the 19th century, a lot of Tatars fled after the Crimean Wars because some of them have sided with the Ottomans. Particularly amongst the Karaite and others from Eupatoria, but other ones completely sided with the Imperial Russian forces. Their main trials and tribulations didn't occur during the period of the Russian Empire. It occurred during the early 1920s when Bela Kun, the Hungarian Bolshevik, became a de facto ruler in Crimea, and oversaw the brutal massacre of not only the Tartar nobility, but any nobility or so-called bourgeois classes he found in Crimea.
Yeah, that's an interesting part of the book. We'll say more about that in a little bit. But what I found interesting about the stuff that you've just addressed is this kind of ambiguous relationship between the Tatar Khanate and the Ottoman Empire, and how the Tartars seemingly were a big part of all this history of the era, whether it's with the entering debates about Ukrainian identity or its relationship with Poland, Lithuania, that it was a very complex history that the Tartars were a part of. And I was wondering if you'd say a little bit more about where the Crimea plays in this role of this history during this time period. I know this is a broad question, from roughly, the 1600s to, the annexation in 1783. I was wondering if you'd say a little bit more about that.
The relationship to Tartars, to Russia, was not merely as a thorn in the Russian flesh, it was far worse. The reason being that the Tartars more than once threatened Moscow and even, captured its periphery. And the Tartars, some of the Tartars' principal economic activity were slaving. Now, the word in English slave comes from the word Slav. And Slavs, particularly blonde, blue-eyed Slavs, who were big as men and attractive as ladies, were highly sought after throughout the Ottoman Empire. This did not prevent, also, it must be said, the Christian Genoese from dealing in them as slaves, because the Genoese were, of course, traders. But at the end of the day, Rus in the beginning, and then Russia as it was transmogrified into, was terrified of Tatar invasion. Now, of course, most of Russia, except for Novgorod and the far northwest, were captured by the Mongols. It has to be said, though, that the so-called Mongol yoke in Russia and Rus was not always perceived as such. You have to remember, for example, that the great Russian saint and hero, Alexander Nevsky, defeated the Baltic Germans, the Teutonic Knights, with the aid of the Mongols. He was allied to the Mongols. So the Mongols also, it can be said, particularly with respect to Moscow, enabled Moscow to strengthen at the cost of other principalities. And it meant that, for example, tribute to be paid for centuries to the Mongols, to the Tartars, had to go through, were collected by Muscovites. And that, whilst it also brought funds into the Tartars, that enriched Moscow and enabled Muscovites to strengthen their power until finally, in the course of the 15th century, they declared themselves independent of the Tartar yoke, so-called.
Yeah, and it also, I'm glad you brought up many of those points. And it gets wrapped into the Russian Empire's rise with the Cossacks, and the Cossacks are getting part of this game. I don't know if you want to call it a great game of diplomacy to deal with the Russian Empire and Poland, Lithuania, and the Tatars. It seemed to be a lot of shifting alliances. I think you may even use that term
Oh.
between the Cossacks and the Russians and the Tartars and the Poles. And it's a very complex subject, very interesting to read.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. I mean, the Cossacks have recently been revived in Russia as the backbone of, in a certain sense, an elite military guard. But at the same time, historically speaking, one only has to look at the Tchaikovsky opera Mazeppa. This wonderful opera takes as its theme a Cossack in the 17th century who switches alliances. Now, Cossacks, by definition, were people who settled on the frontier lands between the Ottomans, the Tartars, and the Russians and the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And so, whilst normally their allegiance immediately around Crimea, because they were Orthodox, tended to be with Russia, that was not always the case. Sometimes they even sided with the Muslim Tartars against Russia. And we equally have to remember that in these days there was no Ukrainian state. The Ukrainian state was created in the 20th century in the wake of the Great War, the First World War. What is now called Ukraine was belonged parts of it to the Ottoman Empire, parts of it to Crimea, parts of it to Russia and Rus, parts of it to the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, and one could even say parts of it to Romania, and also to the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So it was very much a part of the world in which not only the Cossacks, but lots of other people had shifting alliances, and which was multi-ethnic and multi-religious. There was historically no Ukrainian people. There wasn't even historically a Ukrainian language or a Russian language. There was a Slavic language, which were divided up. You can say there were different languages over the years. They became more and more distinct. But I read a fascinating book on Eastern and Central European languages. And the author, a Polish academic, made the point that the concept of Polishness before the middle of the 19th century only was used with respect to the Polish nobility. It was only later in the course of the 19th century that the idea gripped many people and that who wanted independence from Russia, Germany, and Austria, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, to create an independent Poland. In the future, Polish peasants and Jews and other Slavic peoples and German speakers had to be included in the concept Pole. And therefore, everyone had to begin to speak an established Polish language. But again, according to this academic in Poland, a Pole himself, people, the intellectuals of Poland only thought of the Polish nobility as Poles. And so relating that to Crimea and Ukraine, if you were to talk to someone like Gogol and question his Russian identity, the fact that he also lived in what is today Ukraine and used the local dialect and painted these wonderful theatrical pieces and short stories of local people did not in any way take away from the fact that he was Russian as well, and deeply devout Russian Orthodox.
Yeah, this is a minefield. I mean, you've raised so many interesting points there. I can't get into all of them, but like I was telling you in the pre-interview, my trip to the Ukrainian National Museum, like what you just said would basically, I don't think I'm exaggerating, would start a fight. I mean, they literally would take so much offense to that. And I'm not saying what you're saying is wrong, but I'm just to point out to our listeners that there is a huge debate about the Ukrainian national identity raised by these issues and the place of the Crimean Peninsula as center of this. So it's very interesting stuff. And the Cossacks too are interesting because the Ukrainians, at least from what I saw at the Ukrainian Museum, that's central, that they think of the Cossacks as Ukrainian, whereas that's, you know, certainly a debatable
I know Cossacks argument. Who are deeply committed. They live in Kiev. They were born in Kiev. They speak a local dialect. And they're deeply committed to Ukrainian identity as being part of Russia. Now, not coming down and saying, I think Ukraine should be a part of Russia. On the contrary, what I'm saying is if the majority of people in Ukraine want to be an independent country, they should be. But one has to realize at the same time that there are people living in Kiev who identify socially, culturally, patriotically with Russia. There are others who identify with Ukraine. There were also quite a number previously in our own lifetime who identified with Poland and with Romania. Yeah. So it's quite a fraught area. I have no wish to impose any solution on this. They're not my countries, and I have no right to do so. I only want to make people aware that each of these ethnic groups has its own values, its own mythology. And whereas in England, for example, or the United Kingdom, it expresses itself in relatively benign forms. For example, in Wales, the use of the Welsh language, and in parts of west of England, Morris dancing and flying the flag of of St. George. In Ukraine, in Poland, in Russia, in Turkey, because these are all frontier lands, almost one could say volcanic or earthquake fault lines, people feel threatened. And therefore, when people feel threatened, and they can look back to their recent history and talk about in their own families, victims of mass murder, it makes them very on edge. And some of these people can then opt for violent solutions. Now, all of these people, those who call themselves Ukrainian nationalists, those who call themselves Russian nationalists, those who call themselves Tatar nationalists, all of them have family members who have suffered in the wars of the 20th century and 19th century. And therefore, they don't forget it, and they have their own axes to grind. Now, how you create a peaceful harmony in which each of these groups have some measure of respect is the great challenge of our times.
Yeah, I mean, this is very pivotal points, or you made a pivotal points for our listeners, and it's definitely worth thinking about and considering. And we'll come back to it, I think, near the end of the interview. But one of the things this book does particularly well is that it, and I don't want to, you can say as much or as little about it as you want, is it connects Crimean history to art, to architecture, to literature, to bring out a not just straight political and economic history, which I think is a benefit to the book and benefit for our readers. But beyond, even once again, you can say as much or as little about that as you want. One of the defining moments of the book and of Crimean history, in some ways, and perhaps some ways not, is the Crimean War. And I was wondering if you could say a bit more about where the Crimean War fits into your story.
Well, I think the Crimean War has a lot of relevance to us today. Because in the Crimean War, you had the Western Allies and Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, in opposition to Russia, and to flashpoint was Crimea. I see a lot of similarities with the present day, in the sense that the war took place because Russia, literally, in a way, the West even then was far more secularized than Russia. And when Russia said it had a keen interest in defending the Christians of the Ottoman Empire, it meant it. But the West were not that naive, they felt. They felt Russia's real interest. And I have to say, I don't think that was the case, although there was an element in it. They were afraid that Russia would use its position to extend into the Indian subcontinent, of course, Afghanistan, develop a sphere of interest in Iran, and get involved in the Middle East. And neither England nor France, and certainly not the Ottoman Empire, who had lost so much land at the expense of Russia, wanted that. And so in a way of preventing further Russian inroads, whether for religious reasons or for geopolitical reasons, the war erupted. Now, interestingly, Queen Victoria and Prime Minister Aberdeen did not want war, but the Times newspaper was immensely influential. And people like Palmerston and others had drummed up such a hostility to Russia that the public literally started craving for war. And there was one benefit, because Ireland had suffered enormously through the famous potato famines, where huge numbers of people died. And it should be mentioned that a significant proportion of the British soldiers fighting in Crimea in the Crimean War came from Ireland because they needed the work. They needed the food. Now, the tragedy was that at the end of the war, when all of the powers had big celebrations in Paris to celebrate the peace from Russia, from the Ottoman Empire, it has to be said that one of the celebrations involved the Ottoman Sultan and his wives from the harem appearing in Western style at some of these balls. Nothing had changed. So, with almost a million people dead as a result of the Crimean War, it was really a status quo. And so, we should bear that in mind today with respect to Ukraine in Crimea. What exactly is the world getting involved in there? Does the world really understand what's happening and what benefits will come of it?
That is a pertinent question, and I often wonder that too. I'm sure you follow it. The U.S. political dialogue by itself raises questions of how much people actually know about the region and understand the history and cultures. So that's always an issue. But what another thing that comes out from chapter 7 in particular, and other chapters as well, is the issue of Tatar identity and where the Tatars saw themselves as being part of the Russian Empire. I was wondering if you could say a bit more about how the Tatars saw themselves as a people and perhaps a nation during the late 1800s into the 20th century.
Well, I have to say, there is a mythology that there is one Tatar identity and belief. The Tatars historically are composed of different clans, different groupings. There were Tatars of the nobility, Tatars who were incredibly impoverished farm laborers. There was no unified Tatars. There were Tatars who gave down their life for the Tsar in the Crimean War, and other Tatars who sided with the Turks. In the communist period, there were Tatars who became ardent communists, and Tatars who were white Russians fighting against them, and like the clan of Giray, who were the Khans, immigrated to England, where they married into the English nobility. Then you had, in more modern times, for example, there are Tatars who are very keen on Russian sovereignty being re-established in Crimea after, for the first time since 1954. And then there are Tatars who violently oppose Russian sovereignty. Now, even in the Second World War, one has to say, and it's a reality, however unpleasant, that many young Tatar men, the Tatars having been declared Aryans by Hitler, did assist the SS in rounding up Jews and assisting the Nazi regime. Having said that, though, there were other Tatars who won awards as heroes of the Soviet Union fighting the Nazis. Now, fewer Tatars were supportive of Soviet hegemony in Crimea than possibly supported the occupying Nazi forces, which is one reason why, when the Soviets re-established hegemony in Crimea towards the end of the war in 44 and so on, they had the deportation. Their goal was, it was a very brutal deportation with thousands and thousands of people dying in the process. But one element of that deportation was to remove bodies of people, however brutally, of whom significant numbers had assisted the enemies of the Soviet Union. And you have to remember, Britain and France were allied to the Soviet Union. Now, the fact that many Ukrainians, and I'm not talking about now in Crimea, where they have always been a relative minority, but in mainland Ukraine, many Ukrainians were not Nazis. But they hated the communists. And to them, the Soviet Union was more of an enemy than the Axis powers. So it's a very complicated and fraught area. What is, I might be a hero to a Ukrainian nationalist would not be necessarily a hero to a modern Russian or an Israeli whose ancestors were annihilated in Ukraine by the Nazis and those Ukrainians and others who assisted them.
Yeah, and those are all good points. And it raises the issue of what the place of Ukraine, or excuse me, not Ukraine, the Crimean Peninsula in the First and Second World Wars. I mean, you devote a lot of attention to these in the chapter, and we can't do justice to all of it in a short interview like this, but it seems like the Crimea was right in the center of all these debates about Soviet power, the Reds and the Whites. The Germans see it as a strategically important place in both wars, especially the Second World War. So, I mean, you've addressed some of these issues, but I was wondering if you could say a bit more about where the Crimean Peninsula fits into this story of the world wars in the 20th century.
Well, the First World War, the Crimea was not did not have a major role. The Turks had bombarded Russian ships, Sevastopol and so on, at the start of the war, but Crimea was left relatively alone during it. In fact, the Dowager Empress of Russia, Tsar Nicholas II's mother, fled to Crimea and was only removed after the war when the British vessel Marlborough took her away with lots of other members of the nobility. And she eventually made her way to Constantinople, Malta, England, to her sister, the Queen Mother here, and then to her native Denmark, where she eventually died later in the 1920s. Once the Bolsheviks came into Crimea during the Civil War, Crimea heated up, as it were. Really, it was only in the Second World War that it became a crucial area of Nazi interest and then occupation, and they tried to establish what they called a sort of new Gothia there.
Yeah.
Seeing it as an ancient German homeland. But of course, in pragmatic terms, what they really wanted was to be near to the oil reserves of the, you know, round about the Caucasus in the Middle East.
Yeah, you're right. And it's an interesting point about how Hitler drew on his own mythology about the Gothic, what's the word I'm looking for, immigrations that had taken place in, you know, medieval times to justify that. But what also caught my attention in these chapters is how Crimea ended up as part of the it didn't become part of the Ukraine during the 20s and 30s, and then eventually will become part of the Ukraine. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about how the Crimean Peninsula ended up being part of the Ukraine.
It wasn't the medieval period the Germans looked back to with the Goths. It was the millennium previously. Just after, you know, at the time of the collapse of the Roman Empire and the great nomadic migrations of peoples, of Germanic peoples, that is what they look back as sort of the great ur-homeland of the Germans. And, of course, there were pseudo-research teams that went out in the 30s and tried to see whether the Germans actually came from Tibet. So it was quite a complicated mythology. But basically, Crimea was part of an area called New Russia from 1783. That was the whole swathe of territory which was incorporated into Russia either by conquest or by transfer through invitation, as in the case of Crimea, and that became a great province of New Russia, and it's one of its leading governors was Prince Vorontsov. Now, the Vorontsov family intermarried with the families of the Earl of Pembroke in England and went on to, now there are many descendants in England. But to go back to Crimea's status historically, it was part of New Russia. But as time went on I mean, it was the Soviet Union was highly centralized, and before, from the establishment of the Soviet Union until 1954, Crimea was not a part of Ukraine. There is a dispute to what degree it was Malenkov as head of the party, or later Khrushchev, a few months later as premier, to what part, who was the key in the role of transferring it to to Ukraine. Whoever it was, whether it was the one or whether it was the other, it was transferred to Ukraine for a variety of reasons. And I might also add, it was not fully integrated. It remained technically an autonomous republic. So it always had its own identity. One of the reasons it was said was because that if it was Khrushchev, that Khrushchev wanted to smarten his image, having been involved in the deaths of millions of Ukrainians through the this great period of famine, which it was said was inflicted on the Ukrainian peoples to get rid of their independently minded peasantry and make them more docile to the Soviet system. But there were other practical reasons. The Soviet state was run from Moscow. If it was then transferred to Ukraine, it also, there was an element of how funds were transferred to different parts of the empire, what industrial and agricultural new endeavors were going to take place in Crimea. And the idea was if some of them failed, they could blame Kiev, not Moscow itself. So it's a bit of a complicated scenario to extract all the reasons of why Crimea was given to the authority of Kiev. Now, in 1991, after the collapse of the Soviet Union in Moscow, Ukraine was still technically, had broken away from the rest of the Soviet Union, but it was still a communist country. And despite a local referendum held in Crimea, which voted to be independent, join Russia, the Kiev government decided not to pursue that. And Yeltsin, who at the time was coming into power, had other fish to fry. He was not really interested in these matters. Of course, you have to remember, Ukraine had belonged to Russia since 1654, what is now Ukraine, or most of it. That is the parts east of what formerly belonged to Poland, Lithuania. So the idea that he was giving it to, that Khrushchev had been giving it, or Malenkov, a completely separate country, was just not accurate. It was all part of the United Soviet Union. But in 1991, and when Crimea did want to have closer relations with Russia again, and you have to remember the majority of people living in Crimea were and are people who identified with Russia, because there were huge transfers of Russian peoples into Crimea after the Second World War to fill the space of not only the Tatars, but other peoples who had either been wiped out, like Jews, or who had fled. Now, the American Pew Research Survey Council, a couple of years ago, found out, did a survey, which said that 63% of the inhabitants of Crimea favored reunion with Russia. This number can, of course, be disputed. Eleanor Knott, in Open Democracy, criticized it and said, in actual fact, it was only 58%. But whether it's 58% or 64%, it's quite clear the majority of the people in Crimea wanted to belong again to Russia. Now, the Ukrainians are not happy with that. It's fully understandable that lots of Tatars whose ancestors were deported, rightly or wrongly, wrongly in many cases, to probably the majority of cases, elsewhere in the Central Asian, the Soviet Union, is also understandable. But nonetheless, in a world in which we, the majority in a democratic state, are considered to be able to express their views, these views in some way need to be respected. Now, it is not my position. I'm not Crimean, nor Russian, nor Ukrainian. I have no right to make any comment on what happens to Crimea or Ukraine or Russia or anywhere else, which is not my country. So the people who live in these countries are the ones who, for whom the right should be reserved to make these decisions.
Yeah, they're all interesting points that not enough people know about. And before we get into kind of the current debates of where the Crimea is in the 20th century, I was wondering if you'd say a bit more about the quote-unquote rehabilitation of the Tatars during the Soviet period, especially when Gorbachev took over and that commission that Gromyko headed, and the current position with as far as where the Tatars are in the Crimea today, including demographics.
There is no question that the torments the Tatars went through in the deportations were ghastly. And the Tatars were not deported after trials. Those who supported the Nazis were deported, and those who supported the Soviet Union were allowed to stay. No, they were all deported. So there's no doubt that the Tatars as a people were brutally persecuted in the deportation to Central Asia. The reason being that no distinction was made between those who were pro-Nazi and those who were pro-Soviet and those whose families laid down their lives for the Tatar, for the Soviet Union. That was truly a monstrous deportation. But in the many Tatars then returned to Crimea, as you said, in the end of the Soviet Union and thereafter. And Russia, the Russian government, obviously is doing its best in certain respects to weave the Tatars, some of them, into the modern region of Crimea, which has now come under their sovereignty again, de facto, if not de jure. And therefore, what you have is you have those Tatars, possibly a majority, who are not happy. But you have to remember the Tatars are very small, a small percentage of the total inhabitants of Crimea. And whilst they've lived there for centuries, since the 1400s, others like Armenians, Greeks and Jews lived there even earlier. So the point is not to go back and say whoever lives there earliest has a right. It's really, I would have thought now, the best solution is to bring together all the peoples of Crimea to find a happy solution.
Yeah, it's an appropriate point and one that unfortunately seems to be easier said than done. And to get into that issue, I think it would make sense to say a little bit about, before we get into what's going on today and where you stand on that, at least in the book, is the exact arrangements that the Russian Federation and the country of Ukraine made over the Crimean Peninsula during the 1990s.
Well, basically, putting it in a nutshell, The Russian government, I said that Crimea was a separate autonomous region, but of course, Sevastopol was a special case. It had its own identity going back to 1783, because it was Russia's most important military base altogether. You could argue a whole range of ideas and threats permeated more from the south into Russia than from through the Baltic and St. Petersburg, despite the fact that it was until after the First World War the capital of Russia. And so the problem was that Russia, once it became part of Ukraine, and it did de jure, even if many of the local people were not happy with it, Russia was able to renew for a considerable period of time its military base at Sevastopol. We all know about what happened in Crimea. We all know about what happened in Maidan and the complexities of these situations. And one thing one can say, in which Crimea was fortunate, did I think the number of people who died during the, let us call them upheavals in Crimea, were something very limited. They were in single figures, and I think some of them even died of heart attacks during the course of the actions. So, relatively speaking, Crimea did not suffer the violence that took place in Kiev, in Odessa, and in Eastern Ukraine. And for that, one needs to be grateful.
Yeah, that's true, and it's an important point. And at the end of the day, it seems like this has taken on a life of its own, the position of where the Crimea should be as far as Ukraine and the Russian Federation. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on what the appropriate, if there's a solution, international solution out there, what it might look like.
If one looks back, I'm going to bring up an issue from the Caribbean or two. Grenada. Under Margaret Thatcher, a local communist government was elected in Grenada. And the United States was deeply unhappy about this. Now, I'm an American citizen as well as a British national. So I feel, unlike the situation in Russia and Ukraine, that I'm able to give you my opinions more on my own values in this.
Okay.
And as an anti-communist, I felt the United States' Monroe Doctrine, in particular with respect to communism, is justified. If a communist government erupted in Grenada, why shouldn't the United States send in its forces and crush it, which it did, without even telling Margaret Thatcher, its closest ally? And it succeeded. The Monroe Doctrine, everybody knows, means that foreign, particularly European powers, cannot set up a new extensions of their own states in the Americas. Everyone knows that if in Mexico or in Canada, Russia were to get involved in setting up some sort of state in opposition to the United States, there would be great horror. And with reason, I fully understand it. The United States must defend its integrity and not permit a communist takeover on its borders. Now, what I feel was a great mistake of the European Union was to somehow foist greedy eyes on Ukraine. That isn't to say that people in Ukraine, if they so wished, should not attempt much closer relations with the European Union. Of course, they, as a sovereign nation, should be able to do so. But no country can escape its geography. If the European Union and other countries created the impression to Russia, where after all, the Soviet Union had lost up to 34 million people in the Second World War, as opposed to half a million in Britain, half a million in the United States, one needs to be aware that a Russian sense of this incredible death toll is going to make them wary of any threats to their borders. And therefore, it seems to me that people in Europe should have been far more sensitive to what was happening. I mean, in Russia and in Ukraine, that you create a situation in which there is harmony, not one in. I mean, Finland is a wonderful example. Finland in the post-war years was a bridge between the Soviet Union and the West. And after the horrors of the Second World War, that is the Winter War and the Continuation War in between Finland and Russia, there was no violence, there was peace. And people should have striven to make Ukraine a bridge and Crimea a bridge between Russia in its post-Soviet form and Europe and elsewhere. And unfortunately, that opportunity was lost. One excellent vehicle could have been the Russian Church, because the Ukrainian Church, historically and canonically, as accepted by all of the churches of connected to the ecumenical patriarch in Constantinople and so on, recognize the Ukrainian Orthodox Church as being under the auspices of the Patriarch of Moscow. Now, two bodies of churches have broken off in the 90s from Moscow and established their own non-canonical Orthodox churches. Now, it is not my place to intervene in any of this, but it seems to me that the church, with its message of peace, and I've heard Metropolitan Hilarion, the representative of the Russian Orthodox Church and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church abroad, saying that the fault in the conflict is on both sides, and both sides must come together in Christian unity to establish a harmony. But then, as I understood it, he wasn't allowed to go into Kiev. Now, it seems to me that is not the polarization within the church is not a way forward. The church should create a bridge of harmony, and Ukraine should be a bridge. There is no doubt the far west of Ukraine formerly belonged to the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and had lots of Catholics, still does, whereas the east was almost exclusively Russian Orthodox. But again, I can only emphasize from my own view point as an historian and as not being a citizen of these places, of the need for avoiding confrontation and carrying out provocative acts. Russia is going to have a sense of threat, bearing in mind what it endured over the last few hundred years. And one can't just ignore it. There's no point in saying Ukraine and Crimea have nothing to do with Russia. They do. And you can't pretend otherwise. If you do, of course you can insist on it and say Russia has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with Ukraine, just as you can say what happens in Mexico or Cuba has nothing whatsoever to do with the United States. But you are not going to go down the path of harmony and peace.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I've read widely on the subject. You're one of the first that I've heard say something about the role of religion in bridging the gap. I think that's an interesting point and sometimes overlooked. I mean, just diplomatic historians are interested in sanctions and power and formal stuff. I think that's an interesting point.
Well, I have to add here, there have been threats to confiscate monasteries of the canonical Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which are under the Patriarch of Moscow because of this nationalist political agenda. Now, I'm not saying by any means that those who belong to the nationalist Ukrainian Orthodox Church shouldn't have the freedom to carry out whatever religious beliefs and organization they want, but to go and then try to coerce and confiscate a canonical church's property and territory is not the way forward within a Christian body in Eastern Ukraine. Some Ukrainian Orthodox Church under Moscow have been killed.
Yeah, I don't even know. I mean, I know a little bit about it, but it definitely sounds interesting. And it sounds like something you might touch upon in your future work about the Russian Orthodox Church. So that would be...
It's a fascinating subject.
Absolutely. And once again, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to speak with us. You've given us a lot of information and a lot of food for thought. But before we go, I was wondering if you could maybe add a little bit more to what your future scholarship endeavors might be beyond maybe your book on the Russian Orthodox Church.
Well, I'm very interested in focusing on the Ottoman Empire, on Russia, and on this whole volcanic earthquake-like fault line that runs from the Arctic all the way down into the Middle East. And I think the issues that were present 300 years ago, we see now, whether it's conflicts within Islam, between Islam and Christianity, between various nationalist movements and so on. All these issues are very much with us now. And we see that the old-fashioned Wilsonian approach to one nation, one state, is not viable in that part of the world. In my view, Wilson, President Wilson, who was a very kind man, a very learned academic, failed to understand that long-term solutions in Eastern and Central Europe and the Middle East were not those solutions which had been found for North America and Western Europe. And therefore, we have to re-establish what are going to be the mechanisms of state, of religious administration, of peoples in parts of the world in which there is no consensus of values, as there would be in Omaha, Nebraska, for example, or in Basingstoke in England. And that is, I don't have an easy answer. That is something we must try to achieve. And my view is that some of the best messages for peace and harmony are those contained within Christian teaching, and even some elements of Islamic teaching, of Jewish teaching, but not those views propagated by extremists, but those who generally take in their hearts a Christian message that one needs to show love for one's fellow human beings and not bash them over the head or behead them or hang them. That's my view.
It's a very appropriate message and very, very well taken. And once again, thank you for speaking with me. I've taken a lot of your time, but I would tell the listeners, if they want to get an easy to read, this is a relatively short book that you can pick up, that you can, you know, take on a plane or wherever you do and read and really inform yourself about the history of Ukraine and the history behind the current problems. I would recommend this wholeheartedly. And we didn't mention it in the interview, but there's lots of stuff we didn't get into about that are just as fascinating about the deportations, that the Tatars were not the only people deported in 1944, which a lot of people I don't think know about in American history, to the population transfers of Christians and Muslims between the Crimea and parts of the Ottoman Empire, or back and forth between the Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire. It's a very interesting part of the book.
Well, and this is not in the book, but in the late 19th century, when the Bulgarian, within the Ottoman Empire, when the Bulgarian church tried to break away from the ecumenical Greek patriarch and to have its own patriarch still under Ottoman rule, and the Ottoman government accepted that, some individuals had their eyes gouged out, their tongues cut off, by opposing Orthodox communities within the Orthodox fold. So one has to say there is, unfortunately, amongst Muslims and amongst Christians and other ethnic groups, a tradition of extraordinary violence and brutality when a toxic mix of religion and politics takes precedence over what is actually the Christian message of love and harmony.
Absolutely. And on that note, once again, I'd like to thank you, and I wish you the best of luck in the future.
Thank you very much.